On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Ross Inman about the topic of divine immensity and divine omnipresence. So we cover topics like just what are these attributes and how are they related? How is it that God is really present everywhere? What are the ways that this has historically been cashed out among the tradition? And much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or you can check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now, for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of The London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak.
And I'm your co-host, Brandon Askew.
Today, I am really looking forward to introducing you to a new guest, Dr. Ross Inman. Before I introduce him and the topic and everything, I do need to remind you about what we are trying to do, particularly with the podcast. We try to create an intellectual culture that's designed to generate thinking that has various intellectual virtues such as charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. So we've hoped to get all sorts of different thinkers, all sorts of different practitioners together to talk about issues that matter and who have varying opinions on things. And we wanted to model a posture that is kind, that is loving, that is hopeful, that is faithful. All these things that we see throughout the scriptures that are commended to us as how we should be as Christians. So whether we agree with them or not, we want to model that right posture. But I think today we have someone who is much closer to where we probably both are as far as our own confessional commitments, et cetera. And I'm really looking forward to this because we're actually physically in the same location. Most of our podcasts these days are not in the same location. Me and Brandon, we set up shop at our own house. We record over the internet with somebody who lives, 2,000 miles away. But today, Dr. Ross Inman is, probably like 10 minutes from my house. So we're sitting in his wonderful office and enjoying this conversation together. And I'm sure you all would have enjoyed the conversation beforehand and the conversation we will likely have after. But today we're talking about divine omnipresence. For my part, I don't know of anyone who's been thinking about divine omnipresence at the level that Dr. Inman has. So this is going to be a treat, I think, for both all of you who are listening and for me. I've read his initial paper back from, I think he said 2014. I read that probably way too many times because I'm not smart enough to understand all of it. Probably 15, 20 times because it's just delightful. Now he's got this other chapter that just came out in this beautiful volume, the T&T Clark Handbook of Analytic Theology, edited by James Arcadi and J.T. Turner. And he's got a chapter in here on it, which I think is a little bit compressed version of that original paper with some clarifications, expansions, etc. I think it is a wonderful introduction to the topic. Anyone and everyone would benefit and enjoy this chapter, so I commend it to you. I'll make sure to link to this volume in the notes. I know it's an expensive volume, so what I always tell people is if you want it and you can't afford it, tell your library to buy it. They have a budget, you can get it there, and then everybody can enjoy the riches of analytic theology. So before you guys are tired of hearing me, so let's hear from Dr. Inman. Ross, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself for those who aren't familiar with you, and then what is it that piqued your interest in this particular topic of divine omnipresence? It's not like you read a bunch of people talking about divine omnipresence and you think, well, that person's wrong. I want to write something that's better than them. It's just not there. So tell me about that.
Well, thanks, Jordan and Brandon, for having me on. This has been a long time coming. You've been very patient with me, so thank you very much. And do call me Ross, please. So I teach here at Southeastern Seminary. So I'm an associate professor of philosophy here at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, right here in Wake Forest, North Carolina. And I've been here for a few years teaching philosophy and apologetics. Here at Southeastern. And gosh, when did I originally get interested in omnipresence? I have to say it was around either late 2013, early 2014, when I was reading Dallas Willard's Divine Conspiracy, of all things. And I've got the page open here, and I have jotted in the margin, potential research topic. This was late 2013, early 2014. And Willard, if you haven't read Divine Conspiracy, highly recommend the book. It's a one of these paradigm shifting books in spiritual formation. Willard has a section called Spirit and Space. And let me just say real quick what Willard says here. He says, at no place, I think, does our contemporary mindset more strongly conflict with the life and good news of Jesus than over the understanding of space. He says, if we are to make sense of Jesus's teaching and practice of the kingdom of the heavens, we must understand what spirit and the spiritual are and how they are in space. And that really gave me pause, to be honest. And it gave me pause in the sense of how has the Christian tradition understood God's relationship to space? There's quite a flood of literature, honestly, on divine eternity, mm-hmm. God's relationship to time, but really a paucity of material out there on God's relationship to space. I mean, you could really almost count on one hand. Articles devoted to God's relationship to space. Only one book still to this day. Luco Vandenbrom has a book called Divine Presence in the World. He is a theologian. In the last 50, 60 years, wow. One single book on divine omnipresence. So if you're a grad student out there, if you're looking for a dissertation topic, which I do know some PhD students who are working on divine omnipresence, that is an area ripe for further exploration. So that at least got me thinking, guys. So, hey, this is a fascinating topic. In what sense is God related to spatial reality? Yeah. Really kind of is what got me going on the topic.
Yeah, I imagine most people would say they affirm that God is omnipresent. But then if I were to ask, what does that actually mean that he's actually present everywhere? I think you'd quickly find out that we don't have a good grasp on what it actually means. Mm-hmm. So I guess in your chapter, you've categorized, I guess there's these two broad categories, divine immensity, divine omnipresence, this absolute and relative distinction that you make. Talk to me about some of the basic distinctions that we should be aware of and be thinking through to help us categorize the topic itself.
So I guess just as broadly as we can think about it, to say that God is omnipresent is to say that he is present to or present with every place. Mm-hmm. Now that is quite broad and can be unpacked in various ways. And I think the various ways in which God is present to every place is really where the nub of the disagreement lies in terms of in what sense is God present to every place. But most generally, omnipresence is the claim that God is ubiquitously present to every place, every spatial place. Now, immensity is really a seriously neglected divine attribute today. Yeah. You would be hard-pressed to find philosophical articles, specifically analytic articles on divine immensity. I can think of one that's been published in the last 30 years, at least in a mainstream academic analytic journal in faith and philosophy. Richard Cross has a piece on divine immensity, right? No surprise there. Looking at Duns Scotus's view of divine immensity. But immensity is really, historically, what I've tried to argue in this chapter, immensity really is at the foundation of divine omnipresence. These are, historically, these are two separate, though closely related, divine attributes. Divine immensity really is just a corollary of divine infinity in my understanding of the tradition, how this is understood. So divine immensity is really, it seeks to capture God's being uncircumscribable, without limit, without bound, without limitations in any sense whatsoever. And in particular, immensity is God's infinity with respect to place. Yeah. So his being unbounded or unlimited with respect to created place. Actually, eternity has traditionally been defined as well as God's infinity or illimitability with respect to time. Mm-hmm. So infinity really is, along with divine immensity, really at the foundation for how, at least classically, theologians have thought about divine eternity and divine omnipresence. So how these two attributes connect. So you mentioned the absolute and relative distinction. So an absolute perfection or an absolute divine attribute is just, we're talking about how God is in himself, ad intra, apart from how he relates to creation or creatures. So an absolute attribute is traditionally been understood along the lines of, amongst others, but divine immensity. So God is immense whether or not there is a creation, right? So this is how he is in se, this is how he is ad intra. He is unbounded, infinite, unlimited in any respect whatsoever. But omnipresence, interestingly enough, has been traditionally understood as a relative attribute. So this is not an absolute divine perfection, at least historically. This is only a way God is, or we can predicate omnipresence of God since there is a creation. This is a way of picking out God's ad extra relation to creation. So he is, so obviously if there are no created places, God's not present to them.
Yeah.
But he is immense, whether there are created places at all. But if there are any places, because he is immense, he will be present to them. So what I try to point out is there's this dogmatic connection between immensity and omnipresence that, and I don't want to overstate things here, but is almost entirely neglected in the contemporary discussion about divine omnipresence. It's often treated as a free-floating attribute and not one that organically springs from a deeper perfection, you might say, in God.
That's interesting. That's helpful.
Yeah, those are helpful definitions and distinctions. So in your article, you say historically, this is on page 129, historically, dogmatic reflection on divine omnipresence in the Christian tradition has taken the form of the following threefold schema. God is everywhere by one essence, two power, and three presence. So help us understand what those three things mean, and then what is the relationship between each one of those three things to one another?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, so when you do some digging in the history and development of omnipresence, it's a fascinating topic, and there's always more than you might think. Mm-hmm. historically, there's been this threefold schema that you'll find explicitly stated in Peter Lombard's sentences, in various sentence commentaries amongst the medieval scholastics. Lombard actually traces it back to Gregory the Great's commentary on the Song of Songs. But it's just a way of characterizing the way in which God is everywhere, and in terms of essence, power, and presence. So let's start with maybe God's being everywhere by way of presence, right? So although I'm hesitant to sort of oversimplify things here, so there are different ways essence, power, and presence have been cashed out historically. But let me just give you one kind of common way of unpacking these things. So God's being everywhere by presence was standardly understood to refer to God's omniscience, his being aware of the ongoings at every place and space. So everything is sort of bare and open to his eyes. In this sense, so God knows about the ongoings of every place. So it's a function of his knowledge. So God's being everywhere by presence, oddly enough, it refers to God's everything being open to the divine gaze by way of his knowledge. God's being everywhere present everywhere by way of his power is also referred to in the tradition as him being imminently present or virtually present or operationally present. It just means that God is operating or causally involved with a particular space or the occupant of that particular place. So you have a causal notion that goes along with God's being everywhere by power. He's causally doing things, sustaining, creating at particular spatial places. And then his being everywhere by presence is a function of his knowledge. Now, God's being everywhere by essence is a little bit more difficult to characterize. But let me just say before we sort of move into that area, almost all contemporary glosses on divine omnipresence will stop there. They will define omnipresence either in terms of God's being everywhere by power and or everywhere by presence, in the sense that omnipresence really bottoms out or is nothing over and above God's omnipotence or his causally relating to creatures by way of sustaining them and so on, or his knowledge about what's going on at particular places. And that's where a good many contemporary analytic philosophers and theologians will leave things.
Yeah.
And I guess one thing, whether one agrees or disagrees with this, because I could very well be wrong about this, but just trying to be faithful to how the tradition has unpacked these things as well. Mm-hmm. There's also this other sense in which God is everywhere by essence, right? And it seems to be distinct from his being everywhere by power and by presence. So whether we can get a firm grasp or even an analysis of what it means for God to be everywhere by essence is one thing, not sure.
Yeah.
But it's there. Mm-hmm. And it seems like it's been overlooked in some senses.
Do you think the reason for overlooking that third category of essence is because they want to reject it or because they're just not simply aware or haven't thought about it hard enough? Because maybe I'm wrong. It seems that somebody like Thomas Aquinas would not have the third category of essence as far as I'm familiar with him. Maybe he does. He's got written a ton and I am not a Thomist enough. Not Thomas enough to have read his entire corpus. But it seems that when I've read people on omnipresence, they'll reference somebody like Thomas and use the power presence type distinction and it leaves it there. And I know in your other paper, you kind of cash out a little bit, Augustine, Anselm, and I think you argue persuasively that they're using that third category. So I don't know, maybe based on your own experience reading on these things, why is it that essence is left off? Because it seems, as I think about it, I was talking to you this before we recorded, that if you don't have this essence aspect in it, then omnipresence is nothing. It's not really a divine attribute. It's just the conjunction of omnipotence and omniscience and nothing more than that, which seems odd to me.
Yeah, okay. I see what you're saying. So, you know, some would say, well, look, isn't it better to, where we can, have a reductive view of a particular attribute? So where we might want to say omnipresence is something irreducible to any other divine attribute, that would be maybe a non-reductive view of omnipresence. It's better to get a reductive account when we can, right? And so that might sort of explain the tendency to try to say, well, if we can reduce it in terms of God's knowledge and his power, more power to you. But I guess what to say about whether that's a genuine form of omnipresence. Well, I think it could be, in the sense that God is omnipresent, and here's what that means, is he's cognitively aware of all that's going on in space, and he is sustaining all spatial creatures. And that's just what it means for God to be present to or with every place. I think that's a view. I don't want to definitely say that's not a form of omnipresence. But I guess my main project in this chapter was to try to open up alternative ways of viewing omnipresence historically as to, and I don't even defend the view in the chapter. I'm just saying, here's another more historically entrenched way of thinking about these things, whether it's has merits or not, here it is in our tradition.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
It's something we haven't mentioned, but that you do mention in the chapter is the biblical data that points to omnipresence. So you, Psalm 139, 7 through 10, you have Jeremiah 23, 1 Kings 8, 23 and 27. Acts 17 is another passage that would probably come to mind for a lot of folks. Do you think there's anything, because when I think, and I don't have these passages open in front of me, but when I think Psalm 139, that just screams to me, you know, God is omnipresent by way of presence, the third option in the schema, you know, that he knows my thoughts and all that. But the First Kings 8 passage, is there anything in that passage that you think maybe would invite us to look more at the essence piece or maybe just in any of these passages? Or do you think it's still a matter of, you know, you could... these passages don't really point us in one way or another in how to cash all this out, but just that God is omnipresent.
Ooh, yeah, good. So that First Kings 8 says, O Lord God of Israel, there is no God like you in heaven above or on earth beneath. But will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you. How much less this house that I have built. Insofar as we find any sort of like exegetical or dogmatic reflection on 1 Kings 8 with respect to divine omnipresence or divine ubiquity, one way of understanding this particular text is this idea that God cannot be contained, God cannot be confined or localized to any one region of space or place. This would somehow be in tension with God's perfection. I would argue his immensity, his infinity, not having any bounds or limitations. Not him having any, but it's impossible for him to be bound or contained by either time or space. So I point to this passage here as suggestive, and at least it's a sort of proof text that many classical theologians will point to in talking about divine immensity. So because God is immense, he cannot be contained, much less by this house that I have built, Solomon says. So God's illimitability and uncontainability or immeasurability really is a function of his immensity. Now, one thing that I try to emphasize in this chapter is, again, focusing on the distinction between immensity as an absolute perfection, but distinguishing that from omnipresence as a relative perfection, right? And there's actually an explanatory relationship, as far as I can tell, between these two in the tradition. So it's because God is immense that he is everywhere present, not just by power and knowledge, but in virtue of his essence. Now, so if you go back to that threefold schema, God is everywhere by essence, power, and presence, or by essence, power, and knowledge, right? There's even an explanatory ordering, at least as I can tell, between those three things. So it's because God is immense that he is everywhere by essence, and not just by power and knowledge. So on my understanding, it's in virtue of God's immensity that his essence is wholly present to every place, every created place. And because his essence is wholly present to every created place, his power and his knowledge is also present to every created place. So I don't know if you can track that sort of, there's an explanatory ordering between well, why is one the case? Why is God everywhere by essence? Because he's immense. Mm-hmm. Because he's illimitable, because he's immeasurable, he's uncontainable. There are no spatial limitations. Indeed, there can't be any spatial limitations. But why is God everywhere by power and presence or power and knowledge? Well, because of he's everywhere. He's everywhere by essence.
Right.
So you could say it all bottoms out in immensity. So an absolute perfection explains a relative perfection here, God's being ubiquitously present. But him being ubiquitously present by way of power and knowledge isn't rock bottom explanatorily here, at least as I'm understanding these things. It's his being present by essence. Mm-hmm. And there are various reasons for this, namely, I would argue, divine simplicity historically. But that's at least the picture as I'm understanding it. But that 1 Kings 8 passage, I would think, points more to the illimitability of God, his immeasurability. No mention of power or knowledge or anything like that. But you do find more references to knowledge and power, and as well as theological entailments. From other passages in scripture. But that's a good point about that 1 Kings passage.
So one other distinction I want to get clear on before we just kind of have fun peppering you with questions on practical, I guess not practical, but just more less fine-grained distinctions and more just talk to me about the doctrine itself. You make this distinction between fundamental presence and derivative presence. And I found this a very helpful way to categorize the two views that we've kind of been discussing here. This one view that says, no, it's just power and presence. And this other one that's adding essence into the conversation. So maybe clarify these two versions and how where essence maps on to it in those.
Maybe before I get to that distinction between fundamental and derivative presence, you know, it may surprise you that it was often common to try to tease out how exactly is God everywhere present by essence?
Yeah.
And you actually find a really nuanced taxonomy of modes of presence in the tradition. Mm-hmm. One of which is God's circumscriptive presence. Not God's circumscriptive presence, excuse me. One of which is a way of something's being present at a place. It can be circumscriptively present. It can be definitively present, or it can be repletively present. So you find this distinction in the patristics, but I've been sort of mining some of this out of the Protestant scholastics. Yeah. So you find this in Turretin. You find this in Owen. You find this in Arminius. This is a very common, although they're definitely appropriating this from the medieval tradition as well. But the idea of something's being circumscriptively present is that it's somehow the parts of that thing are commensurate with the various parts of the various places. So take my body, for example. My body has various parts. It has a head, a heart, my hands. These are distinct proper parts of my body. Now, for my body in its entire to be circumscriptively present at a place means that the various parts of my body, my hand, my head, my heart, are each sort of mapped onto a distinct place. So my hands are in one place. My head is in another place. My heart is in another place. So it's almost like I'm dimensively or quantitatively extended in a particular place by having parts extended through space at one part at this place, another part at another place. So obviously you need parts to be circumscriptively present. Now this mode of presence was exclusively reserved for material objects.
Right.
Material bodies. So no spirit, whether God, angels, or souls, can be present at a place in this sense in particular for various reasons, but one is they don't have traditionally parts or proper parts to be spread out or distributed across space in this particular way. Now, another way of being present at a place is definitive presence. So historically, this is the way that created spirits like angels and human souls, though immaterial, not composed of any matter whatsoever, and even materially even mere logically simple, lacking proper parts altogether, they can still be, in a sense, at a place. But it's not circumscriptive presence. It's definitive presence. So this idea of being definitively present at a place is, say, the human soul is definitively present where the whole body is, but it's also wholly present at every part of the body. Mm-hmm. So since it doesn't have parts, you know, the soul can't be partly present in the hand, partly present in the head, partly mm-hmm. present in the heart. Rather, it has to be wholly present wherever it's present. But definitive presence excludes something's being wholly multi-located, in the sense that if the soul is wholly located where the entire body is, it can't be wholly located somewhere else, say where your body is, right. Or located in the chapel. So definitive presence was traditionally reserved for the way that angels can be in a place or occupy space, and the way that human souls occupy a particular place. So they're limited. They can't be present this way just anywhere and everywhere.
Yeah.
So they're not immense, right? They're by nature limited, and they're confined. They're bound to a particular place. But where they are, they're wholly in every part of that place, mm-hmm. right? They're not partly in every part of that place. Now, God was exclusively thought to be repletively present, right? So without parts, classically conceived, God's not distributed across space-time, you know, in the sense that my body is spread out through space. But he's nonetheless in a place. Indeed, he's in every place, but he's wholly in every place. So he's not extended as we would think material things are extended, but he is in a place, but he's not in a place in the sense in which my body is in a place, yeah. nor even in a place in the sense in which a created spirit, like an angel or a soul, is in a place. Wherever he is, indeed, he's everywhere because he's omnipresent. He's there wholly. So he's wholly multi-located. He's yeah. wholly with or present to every created place. So most classical theologians would say how to understand God's being everywhere by essence, even just negatively, he's not everywhere present circumscriptively by essence. Mm-hmm. Because that's unfitting with other divine perfections. He's not everywhere present definitively, because that would mean he's limited or confined mm-hmm. to a particular place. But he is everywhere present by essence, in terms of his essence being wholly present to or with every single created space. Does that make sense?
No. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah. So a question that comes to my mind, think about the definitive presence of an angel or soul yeah. or something. Yeah. How is it that can be extended in some sense, or is it maybe it's not extended? How can it be present in more than just a point sized place and yet not have parts of some sort? Mm-hmm. How does that work?
I think you have to begin to think about extension in more ways than just having parts spread out across space. Mm. Now, in the early modern period, and I'll just reference your listeners to Robert Pasnow's book, Metaphysical Themes. He's got yeah. several really rich chapters on, in the early modern period, thinking about the nature of extension and spiritual extension. You know, Descartes very closely weds being material with being extended, mm-hmm. sort of a kind of distance between parts means you're extended in space. Well, what if you don't have parts? Well, then you can't be extended, right?
Yeah.
But the way that I'm understanding some of these classical thinkers is this is a kind of extension. It's a way of being in a place where that place is not point size. That place is, it does have dimension, but the thing that occupies it doesn't have dimension. And there's a lot to say about that, but I guess a first approximation would be, if you only understand extension myriologically, such that something can only be extended if it has parts, well, then these things can't be extended in any sense. Mm-hmm. But the way that I find being extended used historically is not confined to, it's not analyzed purely in terms of having parts, proper parts, because it seems like souls occupy extended places, like the place where my body is, but without having parts extended across that place.
Okay. So now thinking about fundamental derivative distinction.
Yeah. Okay. So fundamental presence and derivative presence is just basically my way of trying to unpack what it means for something to be present at a place in a derivative and in a fundamental sense. So it may actually turn out, guys, that being present at a place is unanalyzable.
Okay.
And I'm happy with that. I'm honestly, there may not be a further or deeper analysis as to, well, what does it mean for God's essence to be present with or at a place? I'm happy with just saying, well, there's no further or deeper analysis. We know what it's not, but what's the fundamental analysis of God's essence being present at a place? We know maybe it doesn't reduce to power.
Yeah.
We know it maybe doesn't reduce to knowledge, but what exactly is it? In fact, you find Turretin and Peter Van Maastricht too. He says we shouldn't pry too closely into the nature of the way in which God's essence is ubiquitously present in creation, but we know it is. So the fundamental derivative distinction is, so I say in the chapter that something is present at a place fundamentally, only insofar as it's present at that place, but not solely in virtue of standing in either causal or epistemic relations to something that is itself present at that place. So fundamental presence, something's being fundamentally present at a place, amounts to its being present at that place, but its being present at that place isn't exhausted by its standing in causal or epistemic relations to something that's present at that place. So this is a way of capturing there's something more on a fundamental presence view of being present at a place than just knowing about what's going on at that place and even causally interacting with things at that place. Mm-hmm. So presence, though it might involve those things, it's not exhausted by those things. Mm-hmm. Now, what that additional stuff might be is, I think, a really hard thing to characterize. But derivative presence basically wants to analyze something's being present at a place to solely causal and epistemic conditions. Okay, so something's being derivative. It's at a place, albeit derivatively, if it's either in causal contact with something at that place, or it has knowledge about what's going on at that place. And so does that help this sort of this distinction between fundamental presence and derivative presence? And I guess what I try to do in the chapter is you can understand two basic models of divine omnipresence based on these two conceptions of presence.
Yep.
So you can have a derivative model of omnipresence that says God is everywhere present in virtue of his knowledge and or his power operative at every place. Or you could have a fundamental account of omnipresence that God is everywhere present, but not solely in virtue of him knowing about what's going on at every place and him being causally operative at every place.
Yeah. So I think... personally, I think I came in before I studied this, thinking derivative model was the approach that I'd taken. But after reading it, it makes me start rethinking things. I see how you've explained Augustine and Anselm, and I think Turretin's making use of this. And you mentioned Owen, which I haven't read that portion in Owen, but I'm sure that he's got this robust explanation of it as well. And so that makes me think, maybe I should take up and listen and think about this. And as I thought about it, it seems, yeah, I like that idea of adding the additional quality of essence. But at the same time, it makes me start to think, does this, I mean, maybe it's just we've got to push in the, and set, push the pause button and say, yeah, we can't go that far. It's a little bit mysterious, et cetera. We're using the mystery card in an appropriate place. But there does seem to be some sort of worry where does a fundamental presence view where I'm saying God is present by essence everywhere, does that have put me a little bit too close to something like panentheism or put me close to God having an actual body of some sort? I mean, I guess if you're okay saying angels and human souls are definitively present somewhere and they're not bodies, then that worry doesn't seem to be overly serious. But I would think someone who's maybe someone the first time they hear this, those are the connotations that are coming to their mind. Like, well, what about this? How does this not collapse into something like that on that model? Do you have any thoughts on that? Is that a legitimate worry?
One contemporary analytic philosopher whose paper was a chapter in the Oxford Handbook to Philosophical Theology called just Omnipresence was Hud Hudson. Hmm. So Hudson was the first, one of the first philosophers to talk about a way of being in space that doesn't entail sort of myriological extension or this idea of being holy wherever something, a very classical historical notion. But we saw him sort of reconceiving or repackaging this understanding. He calls it intention, a way of being in space that doesn't entail myriological extension. Now, for Hudson, he's working with a conception of what it means to be a material object. In terms of, he defines that in terms of occupying a place or a space, right? So if something occupies a place, then it's a material object, right? And on his view, God not only occupies a place, he occupies every place. Indeed, he occupies the maximal place, you might say, the entire space-time, you know, maximal region. Well, then on that view, on Hudson's view, God's a material object because he occupies a place. Now, I happen to think that's deeply theologically problematic to ascribe a body to God in that sense. But I think when we reach back further historically, we don't find this sort of divide between what's material and immaterial in terms of being at a place or occupying a place or being present to a place. In fact, the medievals, at least the medieval hylomorphists, had a more robust conception of how to demarcate the material from the immaterial, right? Say for Aquinas, it was to have dimensive quantity. Mm-hmm. And the only things that have dimensive quantity are things that have prime matter.
Yeah.
Well, of course, God doesn't have prime matter, nor does he have dimensive quantity. So he's not even the sort of being that can be material. So they had a different way of cutting up something's being material and something's being immaterial that didn't appeal to just being at a place, right? And if immaterial things can be at a place without being material, well, then I think you really cut that worry of, well, is there a necessary connection with saying that God is ubiquitously wholly present to every place in virtue of his essence?
Yeah.
Doesn't that entail theological worries about God's having a body or God's being material? Well, it would, I think, only if you were understanding what it means to be material in terms of occupying a place or being at a place. But again, I would just encourage your listeners to dip back into the tradition to see how they locate immaterial things at a place, angels, souls, and God. But obviously these are not material, nor are they even myriologically complex things. So there must be a way of preserving immateriality and yet having or locating immaterial things in space in a way that doesn't entail they're material, that doesn't entail that they're bodily. Hmm. But on the assumption that to be material is to be at a place, yeah, that does follow. And so I would recommend, instead of kind of biting that problematic theological bullet of saying, well, if you want to go this route with respect to omnipresence, you have to say some funny things about God. I think that only follows on certain sort of philosophical assumptions that I think historically were just not shared.
That's good.
Yeah.
So tell me, Ross, why didn't I learn about any of these distinctions in seminary? And why do they not exist in any of the theological books that I've been reading?
Oh, man.
Where did they go? I'm not a, you know, it's a sociological question, I guess.
They've always been there, Jordan. They've always been there. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe this is just kind of a downstream symptom of our, you know, our being ahistorical generally in terms of our theological training.
Because you've said you see this in Turretin, you see this in Owen. Are there other post-Reformation scholastic type people who are using these types of distinctions?
Absolutely. So, you know, in the 17th century, you really, one of the sort of main polemical disputes was between the Reformed and Socinianism. Mm-hmm. And you had thinkers like Faustus of Sinus, you had Remonstrance thinkers like Vorstius, who denied divine infinity and divine immensity, and said that God is localized to a particular place, namely heaven. Hmm. But he's present everywhere in virtue of his power and his knowledge. Now, if you go back and you read Owen, so the Mystery of the Gospel Vindicated, go back and read Owen's Mystery of the Gospel Vindicated. It's a direct polemical attack on Socinianism. And he lays out all these distinctions. Mm-hmm. And if you read Turretin's Institutes, one of his main polemical foils are the Socinians. And he's laying out these distinctions between circumscriptive, definitive, replete of presence. God's not present just by way of knowledge and power, because he had sort of the Socinians in mind.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting that we're often, or one can run the risk of repeating certain historical aberrations with respect to divine omnipresence that you find many in the post-Reformation period deliberately arguing against polemically. So it may just be a symptom, Jordan. I don't know. I'm just speculating.
No, and isn't it our constant temptation to repeat errors in the past because we haven't done our due diligence in immersing ourselves in the great tradition? So that's good. Brandon, do you have any other thoughts or questions?
No, I don't think so. That was good.
Ross, before we close up on this, have you thought about how thinking about divine omnipresence might shape just my everyday enjoyment of God, my everyday love of him, my everyday trust in him? Is there really any like boots on the ground, practical import to thinking and dwelling and contemplating this particular divine attribute?
That's a great question. That's a hard question. It's a big question.
Yeah.
But it's definitely one that deserves contemplation. Well, I suspect maybe one reason why one might be leery of saying that God is by essence spatially present at every place is that perhaps God competes with things at created places in the sense that there's this sort of competitive relation between God and creatures. So if something is wholly out of place, well, it's going to be hard to get something else in that place if something's already wholly there. But I guess one sort of way of thinking about the non-competitiveness between God and his creation that, I mean, even Aquinas says God is, and Augustine as well, God is truly closer than you are to your own self, to you. That God is present in such a way that his presence can be attended to in precisely the same way that, say, I'm attending to your presence right now as a being that is in space, that a as a being that is present to a particular place. You're in my office, and I'm attending to your presence as one who is shares a particular medium. But God obviously doesn't share the medium of created space in the way that you share it with me. So God can be, because of his perfection and immensity, God can be closer to you than you can even be to yourself, but more so than any created thing can be with respect to you. So God doesn't share the same limitations that you and I share with respect to our way of being in space. So I guess circling back to the original thing that got me interested in divine omnipresence is thinking about the triune God's relationship to space and how he lives and moves and has his being in the creation. Turns out it's much more, at least on this particular way of understanding it. It's not an argument for the view. It's just that God is spatially present in the same spatial medium, but in such a way that doesn't undermine his aseity, that doesn't undermine his independence, or anything like that. So maybe that would be one thing to say. I think there is more, but maybe that would be sufficient. But
that's good. And before we end, I want to say this about Ross. I don't think he would say it himself because he's too humble. But I think he is just a tremendous scholar. There's not a lot in our, me and Brandon are both evangelicals. And below that, you know, we're in the Southern Baptist Convention, whatever you think about that. This is going to be airing after all the drama that's going on. So who knows what goes on there. But the point is, we don't have a lot of serious, engaged scholars, particularly in the philosophical realm. And I think Ross is one of the premier thinkers in that area. He's publishing all sorts of serious, helpful things. Such he's got a book called Substance and the Fundamentality of the Familiar. I mean, you could take that to any institution and then use that as a text, and they would take that seriously. That can't be said for a lot of the thinkers in our own tribal circles. So I just commend you. Read his stuff. He's doing serious thinking, and he's wanting to do it with the classical tradition. I mean, a lot of times we have some serious thinkers, but they're untethered from the classical tradition. So I would gather probably most of our listeners want to be in that. I think Ross is a model thinker in pretty much every way you could think. He loves the local church. I mean, he teaches here at a seminary, training pastors. I look around his office and I can pick books from, he's got a commentary on Isaiah from Alec Motyer. He's got Jim Hamilton's God's, you know, what glory and salvation through judgment. And then you can look over to the philosophical section. You see every serious philosophical work that there is. I mean, he's just this wonderful mix of theologically informed and astute, but also a serious philosopher who is engaged in these areas. So if you're thinking about doing PhD studies, you want to do philosophy-related things, I think Southeastern has a wonderful program. The program, they have a PhD in philosophy of religion. You can come study with Ross Inman. You can come study with Greg Welty, who's probably one of the other premier thinkers in our circles of the world. I mean, he could go teach at Oxford. He could teach anywhere. He's that smart. I think if you come somewhere like here, you're going to get a wonderful education from these two men. And I think there's just a growing interest in philosophical theology and all those related things. And if you've listened to this so far, I think you realize pretty quickly, Ross knows his stuff and he's got a pastoral heart. And so even if you're a pastor, I think this is a great avenue to think. I mean, he's got pastors under him right now. I know one of them, Jason Allen, he's a friend of mine. I'll give him a shout out here on the podcast. He's a pastor wanting to do a PhD in philosophy of religion. I think that's just wonderful and delightful. So I think those of us, or those of you who are listening who are thinking about these things, which is, I think, a fair amount, give Southeastern a look. I think it would be worth your time. And I think if nothing else, you should be reading Ross's stuff because it's really great. So, yeah, that's
too kind.
That's my little plug for Ross. Thanks, I like to encourage and model thinkers that are out there, that you should say, yes, read their stuff. You're going to learn not only conclusions, but just how to think. So I think he really models how to think through these topics. And I think he realized that just through the own episode itself. So this has been a lot of fun, Ross. Thanks for doing this.
Guys, thank you so much.
I imagine everybody's going to want to have you back and talk more about it. So thanks for tuning in, everybody who's been listening to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you guys soon.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.